Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we have a new guest to the Loopcast, and we are going to be talking about a recent article that came out in the Atlantic at the starting of January, on the 13th, January 2018, just in case you're listening to this on a different date and in a different year. We are going to be talking about A New American Leader Rises in ISIS. And today we have Bennett Clifford on the show, and he'll be discussing this joint article that he did with Seamus Hughes and Alexander, and I'm going to apologize if I totally destroy this last name, Melaguru Hitchens. So we're very excited to have Bennett on the show, who's part of this team that does great work at George Washington University's Program on Extremism. So first of all, Bennett, thank you for coming on the show.
No, thank you all for the invitation. For myself, and also on behalf of Alex and Seamus, who, Alex, by the way, you pronounced his name flawlessly.
I was having anxiety about that.
No worries. But thank you so much. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's an honor to be on.
Oh, well, it's great to have you on. And like I said, you're a new guest, and it's always fantastic to have new people on the show to discuss all kinds of amazing research and fantastic work that's being done out there. So for our listeners, just in case you don't know about Bennett, he is a researcher, as I said, at George Washington University's Program on Extremism. He has studied violent extremist movements and organizations in the Caucasus, Central Asia, and the Balkans, as well as supporters of extremist groups in the United States. So he's got a great background in this subject. So to start off with, why don't we talk about how you first became aware of, as I know him, Abu Hamza al-Amriki?
Yes, well, so there's two different kind of threads of investigation to talk about. There's the kind of Abu Hamza al-Amriki side of it, and then there's the Zulfi Hoxha side of it. Right now, we're about to finish up a two-year-long investigation into Americans who have joined not just the Islamic State, but other jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq. We'll publish the report on February 6th. But during this investigation, this individual, first as Abu Hamza al-Amriki, in 2015 and 2017, videos released by the Islamic State's media offices, and then later as part of a court trial as Zulfi Hoxha, we were investigating kind of both of these leads. They came together during the court trial when the Department of Justice identified that the individual who had appeared in these videos as Abu Hamza al-Amriki was the same person as Zulfi Hoxha. So that came together a couple months ago, and then once we had both of those pieces kind of connected together, we decided it was worth a little more airtime on how this story developed.
And it's actually really fascinating, especially for me, because I've seen the videos that Abu Hamza al-Amriki appeared in. And, you know, you hear Amriki and you're like, oh, it's an American. I wonder who he is. So reading this piece, I was just fascinated on how you put together the two who became one, basically. Mm-hmm. So what do we know about his personal background and potentially his reasons for joining ISIS?
So he's from New Jersey originally, from Margate City, New Jersey. Abu Hamza al-Amriki, the individual identified in those videos, is Zulfi Hoxha. His parents previously owned pizza shops in Margate City. And his 26th birthday was a couple weeks ago. We know relatively reasonable life growing up in Margate City. You know, people know the family. After the Atlantic piece was published, there was a bunch of local journalists who tracked down people who knew it. And what we get the sense of now is a couple things. One, that it was kind of an open secret in Margate City that Zulfi Hoxha had gone to Syria and Iraq to do something or another. The individuals that were interviewed in Margate City after the fact did not seem particularly surprised that this had happened. And then the second thing sort of is that there's been a picture painted of him as kind of a misfit in some regards. We talked actually directly with a couple of people who knew the family and knew him in Margate City after the piece was released. And, you know, we got the same picture for all of them. Not many friends, some slight difficulties fitting in. Kind of a loner was the way that one person described him. But what we also do know, and how he eventually kind of linked in with a bunch of other individuals that helped him travel, is that he was a relatively big fan of video games. He maintained profiles on a number of online sites that are used for video gamers to connect with one another, including the popular platform Steam. And through that, and also through kind of a growing interest in militant Islam, he met some of the people that would later help him travel to go join the Islamic State and get to a position of relatively high status there.
I think a great way of transitioning into what you just said is this connection and the connections he made through video games. I'm sure there's other ways he connected with individuals, but he's connected to an individual by the name of David Wright, and I'd love for you to tell us about that connection, how it happened, and what it developed into.
Yeah. So the first kind of inkling we got about David Wright was also in 2015. And I mean, I'm sorry, linking all this stuff together, I'm trying not to ramble or get disconnected here, but essentially, he's a individual from Massachusetts, from Everett, Massachusetts. And in 2015, his uncle, Osama Rahim, was in an altercation with police officers in a CVS parking lot on June 2nd, 2015. And what ended up happening is he pulled out a knife and was subsequently shot. They later revealed that he had been under FBI investigation for some time and had been planning with his nephew, David Wright, as well as another individual in Rhode Island named Nicholas Ravinsky, to plan an attack on a prominent political activist. These three individuals had, through direction of some facilitators in Syria and Iraq, essentially developed what they called, I guess, the martyrdom operations plot for the Islamic State in Syria. They were connected to a number of cases. This one was the one that kind of did them in. Wright and Ravinsky were arrested shortly after Osama Rahim was shot by the police. But later on, as this trial developed, it became revealed that both Wright and Rahim helped Zulfi Hoxha travel to the Islamic State. What they did specifically, according to the transcript of the trial, is that Rahim posted a Craigslist ad for his laptop, and then using those proceeds, helped him buy his plane ticket to Istanbul and then on to Syria to join the Islamic State. Prior to that, it was relatively well known, the links, I guess, between Wright and Rahim and Ravinsky, but the process of adding Hoxha to the mix was only established during the trial process.
And what types of media have we seen Hoxha appear in to continue the conversation on to his experiences once he got to the Islamic State? And we've touched a little bit on videos at the starting of the talk, but I want you to get into more detail because they really do portray an individual, and that helps to track him to who he actually was.
Mm-hmm.
Or should I say is, if he's potentially still alive.
Fair enough. We know of at least two videos produced by the Islamic State that Hoxha appears in. One, he's not identified in any way, shape, or form. He wears a mask. But you're able to tell if you compare the two videos back-to-back that the individual in both videos is Zulfi Hoxha or Abu Hamza al-Amriki. And this was also confirmed by a couple sources familiar with the investigation. In 2015, late October 2015, there was a video released by the media office in the Islamic State's Kirkuk province. It's called Reality of the American Landing, and it was released after an operation into an Islamic State camp, kind of as a retaliation, I guess, to the United States. It depicts a masked man who was later revealed to be Hoxha. He gives a brief speech threatening Obama and promising retaliation for that operation, and then he beheads a Kurdish Peshmerga soldier. The second video was released in May 2017. It was released in a different province, in the Nineveh province of the Islamic State, in their media office, and it's titled We Will Surely Guide Them to Our Ways. It's about a 45-minute video, and it depicts militants from all over the world in the Islamic State, some from Russia, some from the UK, as well as an individual, this time unmasked, who's identified as Abu Hamza al-Amriki. In this speech, he's in a warehouse or a laboratory where weapons are displayed, and he says during his speech that they're the weapons that were taken from military raids against the YPG and other Kurdish forces in Iraq and Syria, as well as the Iraqi government forces. And he's talking about ways that the Islamic State is planning to develop, or was planning to develop, those weapons. Finally, another thing that's included in this 2017 video is he exhorts followers in the United States to carry out attacks on behalf of the caliphate.
And so when these individuals appear in media productions, there's a lot of strategic things going on by using them, and I was wondering if we could talk about that a bit. Of course, the first video in 2015, the beheading video, is important because, as we know, we think it's the first American to be featured beheading an individual.
Yeah, it's the first American, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I wanted to talk about the significance of using an American, especially in ISIS propaganda videos.
Well, we were discussing this as we were writing the piece, and it actually is notable that not that many Americans, in comparison to how many American jihadists are in Syria and Iraq, are featured in propaganda videos. I think the common explanation is you would think that the Islamic State would want to get some kind of propaganda boost in its recruiting pitch to Americans. But ultimately, I think, and one of the reasons why this case is so interesting, is that he's one of the few people we know who are identified as American and featured twice in videos. So they're kind of developing him sort of as a media personality. And they're not just videos where they show him and he's talking for 2 minutes either. He gives about a 5 to 10 minute speech in a 45-minute video, and he's, as you said, he's pictured beheading a Kurdish soldier. You know, so it's interesting that he's taking this role, because we don't tend to see that many Americans in the propaganda produced by the Islamic State. I think the reason you would see more from other Western countries, particularly from Europe, is that it does have that propaganda boost. They know that if they depict somebody from Belgium or from France or from the UK, it's a lot easier, especially during the 2014-2015 time period when, as they say, the gates of jihad were open. People could travel relatively freely to the territories controlled by jihadist groups in Syria and Iraq from Europe. But I think they see less of a potential for American recruitment in comparison to the European counterparts. Part of that is due to geography, just how far away the United States is. I think part of that is due also to the strict laws implemented by the United States. So you see a lot earlier in the Islamic State's propaganda messaging towards Americans specifically, the idea that, you know, travel is acceptable, but it may be better for you to stay in the United States and commit attacks rather than attempting to journey all the way to Syria and Iraq. So you notice even in other videos released around the same time, when you see a British guy or a Belgian guy, they'll say in the video directly, you know, you should travel to the lands of the Islamic State, join the caliphate, help build the caliphate, etc. But in neither of these videos of Zulfi Hoxha, or very few of the other videos that feature Americans, is an American person on camera saying, if you're in the United States, you should travel to join the Islamic State. Now, obviously, there are exceptions, but for the majority of it, I think Islamic State's propaganda message towards Americans has been directing them to stay in place, kind of, and do whatever they can in the United States versus encouraging them to travel.
And as you mentioned at the starting of the talk, a lot of the information putting the two personalities, I guess we could call them that, Amriki and Hoxha, together as one, came from court documents and other documentation that you've come across in your research. So let's talk about that process a bit, because it's very fascinating.
Yeah, and for the broader program on extremism, that's kind of a core facet of our research and what we do. We love court documents, not ashamed to admit it. Our PACER budget will tell you the same thing in that regard. But what we try to do is, through uncovering different federal court documents, either by filing motions to unseal, issuing FOIA requests or just accessing them via PACER or other sources. We try to read through it for kind of in-between-the-lines analysis of what's really going on. So relatively early on in the Wright and Ravinsky cases, we knew that they were connected to an individual that traveled. It was in very kind of obscure language and kind of stuff that was a little more opaque, I would say. But over time, especially once the trial happened, it became clear over time that the individual that they were connected to was Zulfi Hoxha. Now, I think most of the time when we're looking through court documents for information like this, especially about travelers, you don't get the same level of clarity because in a large percentage of these cases, there's never a jury trial. Either the individual pleads guilty or their trial is outstanding. But in this case, there is the benefit of Wright actually testifying on his own behalf, of other individuals testifying against Wright, and also the benefit of a full jury trial. Wright was eventually convicted by a jury in October of 2017, and then he was sentenced to 28 years in prison in December of 2017. And kind of the documents that we get the most information on Hoxha are the trial transcripts, as well as the government's sentencing memorandum, which was issued right before he was sentenced in the winter of 2017. And what those documents show you, especially from the government's end in that sentencing memorandum, are three things in particular. One, finalizing everything that was in the court transcripts. The guy in the video, we will surely guide them to our ways, is Zulfi Hoxha, a.k.a. Abu Hamza al-Amriki. Number two, that individual had appeared in other kind of propaganda videos and was connected to Wright and Rahim, as well as other co-conspirators. And then number three, something that was found specifically through the government sentencing memorandum, is that the U.S. government assessed that Hoxha had taken some kind of leadership role in the Islamic State. They refer to him as a senior commander. And it's interesting because this is the first case where we've seen an American beheading somebody on camera, but it's also the first case in which the government has identified or assessed that an American has risen into the leadership ranks of ISIS.
And do we know where they're getting that implication from?
That level of it is less clear, but suffice to say, during the investigation, they found sufficient evidence to suggest that he had reached a senior leadership position.
Interesting. And do we know if Wright and Rahim had contact with Hoxha once he had arrived in the Islamic State, or was this just the prior helping him to travel to the caliphate?
I believe they were in contact afterwards, but only some of them. It's in the trial transcript, it says that Wright did not contact Zulfi Hoxha after he had traveled to Syria and Iraq. So he left on April 6, 2015. In between about April 6th and April 10th, 2015, there's a series of encrypted messages between Osama Rahim and Zulfi Hoxha that detail their level of connection. For example, Osama Rahim asks Hoxha where he is and how he's doing, and Hoxha replies that he'd reached the territory of the Islamic State and, quote, the Kufar can't touch me now, LOL. So he provides confirmation to Osama Rahim on April 10th, 4 days after he made it, that he had arrived in the territory of the Islamic State. The other thing I'll say is, and we're still trying to parse some of this out, but we know that during their plot to assassinate political activists in the United States, Wright and Rahim, as well as Ravinsky, were relying on some assistance from Junaid Hussein, who I believe I said before is a UK citizen. He had traveled to Syria and Iraq relatively early on, and he kind of became a virtual entrepreneur for the Islamic State, meaning based out of Raqqa and basically reaching out to supporters of the Islamic State in the West who were interested in carrying out attack plots. And during the course of guiding them through this, he would provide information, where's the best place to attack, who should you attack, how should you do it, and other information like that using encrypted messengers like Kick and SureSpot. Now, at some point, Junaid Hussein, in a message to Osama Rahim, references that Zulfi Hoxha had reached an IS training camp. So it's believed that Hoxha had some kind of connection with Junaid Hussein as well, or that at least Junaid Hussein knew of his whereabouts after he had entered into Syria and Iraq. So I guess in some, yes, they remained in contact to some extent after the after Hoxha arrived in Syria and Iraq, but some of it may have been by proxy through Junaid Hussein.
What you just said I found very fascinating, because looking at all of these connections and how they relate to each other, each individual, how they get individuals to a destination and so forth, is so vital for our understanding on how these groups recruit, how they manage individuals, especially foreigners. And I mean, it's fantastic information for the future on seeing how groups operate. I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit, because as you said, these connections are individuals in completely different countries, yet they had connections and contact, which produced this effect of Hoxha going to the Islamic State, being trained, and now being a senior commander in the group.
Yeah, and I think it's especially true that that particular aspect of it is especially important for how we look at recruitment to jihadist groups in the United States specifically. The reason I say that is I feel a lot of the times it's overdetermined as a lone wolf kind of effect, or more broadly kind of a lone actor method of recruitment. We tend to see either individuals who have gone overseas to join jihadist groups, or people who stay here and commit attacks, defined solely based off, that they don't have any connections. And oftentimes it's contrasted with recruitment in Europe or elsewhere, where you do see a lot more of these larger networks, neighborhood-based networks, family-based networks of recruitment. Now, while they may be larger in the European context, that's not to say that networks don't have a factor in facilitating travel or attacks in the United States. And I think this is a relatively clear example of that. I mean, after the attack in Boston on 2015 involving Osama Rahim, the initial kind of first media reactions and reactions to it in the community were largely, okay, this is an individual who is motivated solely by self. Some people use the term self-radicalized. And then as that case broadened, you started getting more people who were connected to him. So you have David Wright, you have Nicholas Ravinsky, and then much later on, you have Zulfi Hoxha, who were thrown into the mix of kind of a small group facilitated via a number of contacts who are all interacting with each other to help plan and determine their eventual course of action in supporting the Islamic State. And that's an especially important factor and something to consider in the future when we look at individual travelers or when we look at attackers, that oftentimes, although we don't see the same kind of dynamics on the scale that we see in Europe or in the Middle East or elsewhere in the world, networks still matter in American jihadist recruitment. And it's very rarely the case that self-radicalization or self-facilitation happen or are significant dynamics.
Would you say that because of the strict laws we have here in the States of traveling to join a group and the security measures we have here compared to some other countries, that the online environment plays a bigger role in the recruitment that we've seen of individuals that are U.S. citizens going to Syria and Iraq?
To some extent, yes, although we see it a lot more. We tend to think of it more in terms of the facilitation element of it. The online environment, like any other tool that groups use, or even like you and I would use it, you know, just being friends with each other on Facebook or connecting with each other on Twitter. In the same way, I think supporters of jihadist groups use those tools to connect with each other. whether they are determinants in their radicalization or reaching their eventual decision to travel overseas or commit an attack are completely separate questions. I think in this case, you see some of that aspect. You know, they reached out to each other on a variety of different social media sites. They all had kind of different purposes to them. You know, you have the gaming sites, you have large chat rooms like PalTalk that they used. And then you, on the other end of that, you have the encrypted messaging applications like Kik and SureSpot. They use all of those tools in very, very different ways and at different stages of their process towards making their eventual decision. It's hard to really parse out exactly whether those sources radicalized these individuals, but they were definitely important tools in how they mobilized and joined it. And we see that across the board in kind of American recruitment to the Islamic State and to other jihadist groups nowadays. You know, I think it's important not to discount the role of the internet, but I don't think that it acts in any different way in the United States as it would in Europe. Now, we see more kind of face-to-face facilitation networks in Europe or elsewhere, but in terms of the online environment, I think both supporters of jihadist groups in Europe or anywhere else in the world and supporters in the United States use the online environment in fundamentally the same ways.
So I'd like to take our discussion to Americans' involvement in groups such as the Islamic State. And in the article you point out, and I'm going to quote, you say, as cases of Islamic State supporters continue to trickle through the American justice system, details are slowly emerging of both the extent of American involvement in the upper echelons of the group and the role of recruitment and mobilization networks in the country. I would love to discuss this because this is a very strong statement and it has a lot of implications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we're investigating these kinds of projects, we realize and they may not be senior positions in the way that we think about them traditionally, but most American supporters of the Islamic State or members of the Islamic State are kind of cast as, frankly, as bumbling idiots. You know, we do see some of those cases as well where somebody goes and joins and they think they're going to become a cook or become a mechanic or, you know, set up a shop with, frankly, to make that decision requires a large deal of naivete, of course. But we also see individuals that are incredibly committed to fight, know why they're traveling, and build on their previous experience in order to rise through the ranks of the Islamic State in a way that few other Americans have. I'll point to one other case example that's relatively similar. A couple months ago in May 2017, my co-author on this piece, Seamus Hughes, and I published another piece in The Atlantic called First He Became an American, Then He Joined ISIS. And it documents the story of another American who was able to reach a mid-level position in the Islamic State. His name was Abdullah Ramo Pazara. He came from Missouri. And essentially, I'm not going to go into the whole story here, but the way he was able to kind of get through the ranks is by having some degree of previous military training and military know-how, as well as reaching out to like-minded supporters in the United States. And while Hoxha traveled with the support of two individuals, or at least two individuals that we know of, Wright and Rahim, Pizarro was connected to about six, potentially more, Bosnian Americans in the United States in a variety of states, again, Missouri, Illinois, California, that all provided him money and supplies while he was fighting in Syria and Iraq, allegedly. I should say that because the trials of those individuals that supported him are ongoing. But we see some similar dynamics in both of those cases, but suffice to say, we may not see it on the same scale as in other countries, but there are Americans who are getting to some degree of leadership positions in the Islamic State. And it's worth thinking about how the group operates in that regard, because I think it's on a scale that you wouldn't see in previous mobilizations of jihadist travelers to other conflicts besides Syria and Iraq.
And on that point that you just made a second ago, We always hear that the amount of Americans is much smaller than other nationalities that have joined ISIS, but do we have an idea now the actual extent of American involvement in ISIS?
We have general numbers, but we don't have the degree of granularity that we would like. The latest kind of estimate provided to the public by the FBI was that 250 to 300 Americans had traveled to Syria to fight. Now, breaking down those numbers further, when people were asked about it, that includes people in IS, it includes people in other jihadist groups like al-Nusra and the like, it includes people fighting for a variety of Kurdish factions. It basically includes anybody that went over there with the intent purpose to fight. It doesn't specify the ideology, it doesn't specify the group. It also includes people who traveled or attempted to travel, and that's important as well because it doesn't include the amount of people that, or it conflates between the people that successfully reached Syria and Iraq and the people who attempted to go there but were apprehended in the process. So what I would say for that number is it gives us some degree of comparison to other countries, but what really would be helpful is kind of a breakdown of how much of that is constituted by the number of Americans who went to, who traveled to join IS and were successful in doing so, i.e. Boots on the ground in Syria and Iraq.
And what about American involvement in recruitment?
We see some cases, I guess, but I touched on this before to some extent, but we see in at least visual propaganda far less Americans. Now, we know a couple of Americans were behind the production of some of the key written IS language propaganda, one of them being John Georgilis, who is a convert from Greek Orthodoxy from Texas, relatively involved in the online jihadist sphere in the 2000s, was arrested for hacking into APAC servers in 2004. In about 2012, him, his wife, and his children left for Cairo, Egypt, and then proceeded onwards in the Islamic State. And from Graham Wood's excellent reporting, we know some degree about his role there in helping with the publication of Dabiq, the official magazine, as well as another of other products, including the Al-Bayan radio service in the English language. There's also another case which will be covered in detail in our upcoming report that will be released on the 6th of another individual similar to Georgilis, was involved in jihadist activity in the 2000s, later found himself in Syria and was relied upon for some of the key theological productions of the Islamic State in Dabiq, as well as in Rumia and other sources that were distributed online.
Very interesting. I really look forward to that report when it comes out because it's going to have a lot more fantastic info for all of us that have been following developments and individuals that are related to ISIS and groups in Syria and Iraq. So thank you for putting that out and putting the work in.
And I mean, I'm sorry, I've used too much of your show for shameless self-promotion already, but on the previous point as well about the numbers of Americans, or the FBI's estimate of the Americans fighting in Syria and Iraq. It's not a comprehensive estimate, but we've been able to track down about 64 Americans by name, all biographical information, when they left, how long they were there, who they fought for, when they died, what state they came from, information like that will be included in the upcoming report on 64 Americans who fought for jihadist groups. So ISIS as well as al-Nusra and other groups.
Fantastic. So going back to Hoxha and his experience and his story, when considering his story, what can we learn about foreigners' roles in ISIS, the structure of the group, and potentially its future if it has one?
Well, the future thing is the one that gives me the most pause. I mean, we're unclear about Hoxha's status. At the moment, have not gotten good confirmation that he's either alive or that he's dead. And in some regards, the as the self-proclaimed caliphate crumbles in Syria and Iraq, as IS loses more territory than it's lost before, and we get closer to kind of these the destruction of the organization, or at least its retreat to a phase that it resembled before it had established the caliphate in 2014. The big question from everyone has been, okay, we know, like, a lot of people from various countries went to go join the Islamic State. Where are they now? We've only heard confirmed death reports for a small minority of them. And really what's giving a lot of people, I think, a lot of pause is, where exactly have they gone? Have they transferred onwards to other jihadist campaigns that are just opening up in Afghanistan or the Philippines? You know, are they hiding out in Turkey and waiting to go back? Are they holed up in Syria somewhere? Are they dead? Are they being imprisoned by the Syrian government or Kurdish forces or the Iraqi forces? And I think the general kind of sense that we'll be dealing with even after the last vestiges of IS territory are destroyed is, for not only the United States, but for all these other countries as well, trying to track down individuals from this mobilization and figuring out where they went. And in the American case, we can rely on a lot of examples where somebody that was active in one jihadist campaign left that jihadist campaign and went to another one. And what they become is kind of repositories of knowledge. And these individuals have an outsized effect on promoting future mobilizations to different campaigns. We found that in numerous ones, especially the 1980s mobilization to Afghanistan. There were several individuals from that mobilization, Americans, who went there and then became high-profile figures when the conflicts in Bosnia and Chechnya opened up. And I think what we'll see in the future, specifically regarding American travelers, is a couple of these guys and gals that we have not tracked down or can't verify their whereabouts will pop up at some point in a different context. That's why I think it's important now, as the dust is settling, to try to track down some of the biographical information, some of the networked associations of these IS travelers, especially ones that have appeared in propaganda, and especially ones that are assessed to have taken leadership positions, to try to figure out what the next steps are, and try to ensure that if Zulfi Hoxha does rear his head up in a different campaign, or if he arrives back in the United States, or if we actually can confirm that he has been killed overseas, that we're well prepared to deal with that kind of situation.
Realistically, in your opinion at least, how likely is it that Hoxha would even try to come back to the States? I know that's the major worry of governments across the world that have citizens that have joined ISIS and groups in Syria and Iraq. But looking at some of the cases, yes, we have had some individuals that have tried to return to countries such as Britain and so forth. However, there are also a lot of other cases that the individuals that have traveled overseas know that they're traveling there to stay because they know that there's not going to be a positive welcome for them back home.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, for Hoxha specifically, it's very improbable that he would want to return to the United States. I mean, I felt horrible about it, but when they went to go interview his mother indicated that he had not called in a substantial period of time. He doesn't seem to have any contact with his family. At the same time, I think it would be unlikely that even if he did want to return to the United States, that he would be able to. You know, countries, not just the United States, but other countries in Europe, in the Middle East, have stepped up their prosecutions of individuals who are trying to travel back to their respective home countries very substantially, and it makes it very difficult. Now, what we see more often is that countries without those measures in place haven a certain amount of Islamic State fighters who are just waiting there to return home. I can't speculate as to whether Hoxha's in one of those countries, but I think the most likely thing, if he's still alive and he's gotten out of Iraq and Syria, is that he would be biding his time in one of these transit countries, waiting to return somewhere else or go on to the next battlefield.
So I know you're a listener of the Loopcast, and you probably know that if time permits, we like to give our guests a moment to touch on something we might not have touched on in the talk, or have a final thought, or a final example of more work they're doing, or something along those lines. So I wanted to hand the floor over to you for that.
Yeah, fair enough. Again, I'll go with the latter option just because we're really excited for this upcoming report. And if you've enjoyed listening to this episode specifically, we'll touch on a lot more of these details in a much broader context when we release it. So, yeah, February 6th, we're having an event at the Program on Extremism if you're in D.C. on that date. Otherwise, we'll release it on our websites. It's called The Travelers, American Jihadists in Syria and Iraq. And it's authored by Seamus Hughes, Alex Melgrew-Hitchens, as well as myself. So we're looking forward to that and hope you take a read.
I will definitely be reading it, and maybe we can get you or you and the rest of your teammates on the show to also discuss that, because there'll be much more detail and exciting information, it sounds like. So thank you so, so much for coming on the show, Bennett, and discussing this piece and what is coming up in the future as well.
Thank you as well.